Well, good morning, everybody, and thank you for being here today to share the Dharma together. On quite a beautiful spring morning. Friday we had snow, now we're back into spring again. Welcome to Colorado. For these teishos, please feel free to shift your posture if you need to, but please do so quietly and unobtrusively. And however you sit, keep the back straight and the head up. Quite a few years ago now, when the Zen Center moved into the old Christian Science Church in West Highlands, our Dharma father, Danen Henry Roshi, had a vision of a comprehensive program of practice and training that included a school of Zen arts and studies. This was to include instruction and practice in such things as calligraphy, sumi-e painting, ikebana, that's flower arranging, and poetry. It's quite possible that in our new building, we may yet expand toward that vision. But whatever emerges, I truly hope that poetry has a major place in it. In our Sanbo Kyodan lineage, we have a curriculum that includes four major collections of koans. In those four collections, every single case, without exception, is accompanied by a verse, usually of somewhere between 4 and maybe 8 or 10 lines. These verses are koans in their own right and worthy of serious study. There are countless stories of Zen adepts, or not so adept, coming to an awakening and immediately composing a gatha, a verse, expressing their understanding or gratitude to their teacher. The ancients used to hold contests in which practitioners would vie with each other as to who could compose a verse that would most directly express an understanding of the great matter. Robert Aitken, our Dharma grandfather, wrote an entire book of gathas, The Dragon That Never Sleeps. In preparation for Jukai, part of the assignment is to write a verse to accompany each of your paragraphs on the paramitas, the precepts, the bodhisattva vows, and so on. I think many of you here are somewhat familiar with what we call Zen literature. You may even be familiar with some of the poetry of Ryokan or Basho. Here's a couple of examples. The sound of maple leaves falling in this mountain village makes it hard to tell a rainy day from one that is not. That's Ryokan. The old pond has no walls. A frog just jumps in. Do you say there is an echo? It's Basho. What is it about the writing of poetry, verses, that is so important, not just in Zen, but in many spiritual traditions? Entangling Vines, case 196. Long ago, there was a scholar official named Zhang Zhuo. After reading the Sutra of the 1,000 Buddha Names, he asked Zhang Sha, "All I saw was the names of hundreds and thousands of Buddhas, but what Buddha lands do they live in? Do they teach living beings?" Zhang Sha said, "Since Cui Hao composed his poem, The Yellow Crane Pavilion, have you written a poem on that subject?" "No, I haven't," Zhang replied. Zhang Sha said, "If you have time, you should write one." A little background here. Zui Hao's poem celebrates the Yellow Crane Pavilion. And here's its story. The Yellow Crane Pavilion, overlooking the Yangtze River, is a famous landmark in Hubei province. Right across from it in the river lay the picturesque Isle of the Parrots. Long ago, there used to be a drinking place here, run by a man called Shin. A strange old man used to come to Shin's place to drink. Though he never had any money, Shin never pressed him for payment. One day, after this had gone on for some time, the old man took the peel of an orange and with it drew a picture of a yellow crane on a blank wall. Later, when customers would clap their hands and sing, the crane on the wall would flutter and dance. The bar became famous, and Shin became wealthy. 10 years went by, and the strange old man appeared again. He blew a flute. A white cloud came down. The crane flew down from the wall. The old man climbed onto the back of the crane and rode the white cloud off into the sky. Afterward, Shin built a large pavilion that he named the Yellow Crane Pavilion, after the drawing of the crane. So, the Yellow Crane Pavilion is a famous poem by an 8th century Chinese poet, Zui Hao. Here's an English version by Stephen Owen. That old man has already ridden the yellow crane away. And here in this land, there remains only Yellow Crane Tower. The yellow crane, once it had gone, will never come again. But white clouds of 1,000 years go aimlessly on and on. Clear and bright in the sunlit stream, the trees of Hanyang. Springtime's grasses, lush and green, all over Parrot Isle. Sun setting, the passes to home, where can they be? Beside this river of misty waves, it makes a man sad. This poem was so highly regarded that no poet, not even the great Li Bo, ever again wrote a poem on the subject of the Yellow Crane Pavilion. Long ago, there was a scholar official named Zhang Zhuo. After reading the Sutra of 1,000 Buddha Names, he asked Changsha, "All I saw was the names of hundreds and thousands of Buddhas, but what Buddha lands do they live in? Do they teach living beings?" So this scholar official, Zhang Zhuo, sees a sutra. Now, as we know, the sutras are said to be the discourses of the Buddha. But anyone who has explored some of the sutras finds them to be an enormous challenge. The Abhatamsaka, or Flower Garland Sutra, the Lankavatara Sutra, for example, and others, are filled with hundreds of names of Buddhas and great bodhisattvas, all enlightening beings and other beings, praising the way, the Buddha, and telling their stories. Any of these might be referred to as the Sutra of 1,000 Buddha Names. Nobody is sure which one is being referred to. These lengthy works with their lists, repetitions, long verses, and so on, are this way because the early sutras, especially those of the Pali Canon, are derived from the oral tradition. They were not written down until a couple of centuries after the Buddha's passing. So Zhang Zhuo, a product of a literate culture, is understandably overwhelmed. Reading stuff like that is way harder than listening. And it's very easy to wonder, who are all these guys? Where do they hang out? Whom do they teach? In our rather hard-headed, down-to-earth Western tradition, the question might not make sense at first glance. But the Vimalakirti Sutra gives us a clue. Although a wealthy householder, Vimalakirti lived in a small 10-foot square hut. Yet within this little space, he could accommodate 8,000 bodhisattvas, 500 disciples, a great number of sakras, brahmas, lokapalas, and many hundreds of thousands of gods and goddesses who all followed the crown prince Manjusri to listen to the Dharma of Vimalakirti. How is Vimalakirti able to fit all these worthies into his tiny hut? The same way the 1,000 Buddhas fit into the sutra and into our minds. All those hundreds and thousands of Buddhas of the great sutras, where are they in this moment? The Shangzhuo remains puzzled. All I saw was the names of hundreds and thousands of Buddhas. But what Buddha lands do they live in? Do they teach living beings? Now, in reply, Changsha might have given a lecture here, explained something about the doctrine of emptiness, oneness, or whatever. But that would be just more words. And Changsha has had enough words, at least enough of those kinds of words. Changsha said, since Sui Hao composed his poem, The Yellow Crane Pavilion, have you written a poem on that subject? Now, what does a famous poem from 100 years before have to do with anything? The great teachers were masters at redirection. Here, Zhang Zhuo is completely hung up on names, numbers, and places. We get that way sometimes, don't we? Especially around tax time. We have to get everything right. Everything in its place. We have to understand everything. In case 20, in the Wumin Guan, a monk asked Feng Shui in all earnestness, speech and silence are concerned with equality and differentiation. How can I transcend equality and differentiation? Feng Shui said, how fondly I remember Jiang Nan in March, the partridge chirps among the scented flowers. Here we have a monk who is worried about form and emptiness, speech and silence, being and non-being. And Feng Shui quotes another old poem, faint left, go right. Faint right, go left. And Changsha pulls a switch. He asks Zhang Zhuo, have you written a poem on the Yellow Crane Pavilion? No, I haven't, Zhang replied. Changsha said, if you have time, you should write one. Yes. Write a poem that no one else has ever dared to write. Changsha presents Zhang Zhuo with a challenge and completely takes him away from his concerns about the minutiae of the sutra. Yeah, here's one of the greatest poems of the Chinese language. Okay, pal, you take a shot at it. Cui Hao realized the Yellow Crane Pavilion. What is your realization of the Yellow Crane Pavilion? What is it about poetry that releases the mind from minutia that one gets so caught up in studying sutras or tax forms or even koans? Someone once asked Robert Aitken if the great matter was at last being approached by the high-energy physics experiments that were revealing, maybe, the ultimate nature of matter. Aiken's reply was that he didn't think so, that it was the poets who were coming closest. Scientists at Exeter University in the UK have found activity in a reading network of brain areas, which is activated in response to any written material. In a specific comparison between poetry and prose, they found evidence that poetry activates brain areas such as the posterior cingulate cortex and the medial temporal lobes, which have been linked to introspection. Now, to bypass the jargon, what this indicates is that a poem stirs introspection. And to write one also requires introspection. Poetry comes from a different part of the mind. It is the part that simplifies, that looks more directly at things, is less likely to get hung up in trying to be accurate. Tsui Hao wrote his poem. He fully realizes the Yellow Crane Pavilion. He comes forth from that realization. Writing short verses or gathas is a wonderful practice. And the beauty of it is they don't have to be any good. It is not the product that is important. It's the process, the introspection, the zazen. If you make a poem from your direct experience in the moment, as the moment, it will be unique and unmatched. How could it not be? No one can ever duplicate it any more than they could live your life. No one can write Tsui Hao's poem or his life. No one could write your poem, your life. Still, you should write a poem about the Yellow Crane Pavilion. Can John do that? Can any of us do that? If you have time, where will we get the time? Each one of you must write your own poem, therefore you must find the time. What is the most valuable time we have? It's the time we spend in introspection, in zazen. What will come forth from that zazen? Each one of us must realize our Yellow Crane Pavilion. We must realize it thoroughly. And we then write a poem. It might be in words. It might be in movement. It might be in music. It might be in drawing. It will be a poem no one else has written, that no one else can write, for it comes not from the usual place. It comes from no place and no time. It comes from this moment. Never seen before, never to be seen again. Here are a couple of attempts by an obscure American poet. Me. Flowers nod at night, unsupported by their stems. Wind sighs through the trees. The grasses bow in agreement. And then, 8,000 Buddhas dwell in the Yellow Crane Pavilion. It sits on my little table, steam coming out of the spout. I pick it up and pour tea into the Yellow Crane Pavilion. The Yellow Crane Pavilion picks up the cup and drinks tea. Roses wither and die. Are they still roses? You there, what is your poem of the Yellow Crane Pavilion? Together with all beings, we realize the way.